Welcome to the debate. imagine you are walking through a garden and you come across a dying plant.
Okay.
Its leaves are yellowing, its stem is drooping. Standard traditional psychiatry has historically functioned a bit like a gardener who looks at that yellow leaf, diagnoses it as yellow leaf syndrome, and decides the best intervention is to just paint the leaf green.
Right. Treating the symptom in complete isolation.
Exactly. It rarely steps back to examine the soil, the quality of the water, the root system, or the surrounding ecosystem that the plant actually relies on to survive.
And the counterargument to that is, well, if the plant is actively wilting, you still need precise scientific interventions to save it. You know, you don't just philosophize about the nature of the soil, you measure the nitrogen levels. You check the soil pH, you apply targeted nutrients.
Which brings us to our topic today. We are examining Dr. Bishara Sahli's 2026 academic white paper, Living Coherence and Neuropsychiatric Disease.
A very ambitious piece of work.
Oh, incredibly ambitious. This text proposes a radical shift in how we understand mental illness. It basically argues for replacing our reductionist views of psychiatric disease with what Dr. Sahli calls a life coherence framework.
Right.
Instead of isolating symptoms, this approach integrates biological regulation, the patient's lived experience, and their social conditions into a single, unified philosophy. So our debate today centers entirely on a core tension within the source material.
The core question being, does this approach provide the missing grammar to finally unify biology, emotion, and the environment?
Exactly. Or conversely, does it risk overcomplicating practical psychiatric care by diluting the empirical precision we desperately need for acute medical crises? I argue that this framework is a necessary revolution because it stops treating patients as broken machines and starts treating them as living organisms desperately trying to remain viable.
And I argue that while the framework it's phenomenologically beautiful, it really respects the patient's experience, it ultimately lacks the data-driven rigor of emerging systems like RDoC or HITOP. When lives are on the line, we need empirical boundaries, not philosophical poetry.
Well, let's lay the groundwork by looking at the problem Dr. Sahli identifies with our current models. Systems like the DSM-5-TR or the ICD-11 are essentially rule books for categorizing symptoms. You have a certain number of symptoms for a certain number of weeks, you get a diagnosis.
It's a checklist.
Right, a checklist. But the paper argues these are only partial truths. They completely fail to capture the actual living process. To replace this, Dr. Sahli introduces living coherence, which involves several layers of human functioning. I won't list them all like a textbook, but the foundation rests on a concept called autopoiesis.
Which is a very dense term.
It is, yeah. But mechanically, it just means self-creation or self-production. Think of the difference between a rock and a living cell. A rock just sits there and erodes.
Sure.
A cell, however, is constantly taking in nutrients, repairing its membrane, and actively maintaining its boundary against entropy. It is autopoietic. Dr. Sahli argues that psychiatry has basically forgotten it is dealing with autopoietic organisms. We also have to look at structural coupling, how that living organism locks into and interacts with its specific environment.
I come at it from a different way. The field of psychiatry is already well aware of the limitations of the DSM. And, you know, we are evolving past it. But we are doing so through rigorous empirical science, not abstract philosophy. Consider the hierarchical taxonomy of psychopathology, or HITOP.
Which is dimension-based.
Highly dimensional. Instead of saying you simply have depression or you don't, HITOP uses massive empirical data sets to map internalizing and externalizing symptoms on a measurable spectrum. Or look at the NIMH's research domain criteria, RDoC.
Right.
RDoC doesn't care about DSM labels. It looks at exact biological mechanisms. How does the brain's reward circuit function? What are the measurable genetic or molecular markers of anhedonia? It is deeply operationalized. When Dr. Sahli's paper imports concepts like autopoiesis or Catherine Peel Kaufman's idea of emotional sentience.
The idea that emotions are ancient biological survival signals.
Exactly, rather than just psychological feelings. It's undeniably fascinating, but how do you measure emotional sentience in an emergency room? The paper itself admits these constructs require vast empirical operationalization before they can be scientifically validated.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. It isn't just theoretical poetry floating in the clouds. It is a rigorous attempt to translate biology into clinical practice. To bridge that gap, the paper introduces what it calls the seven primitives clinical grammar.
Right, the seven dimensions.
Yes. Rather than checking off diagnostic criteria, a clinician formulates a case using seven core biological and experiential dimensions. For the sake of clarity, let's just focus on two of the most crucial ones, margin and constraint.
Okay, let's apply those. How does that actually change the diagnosis in a clinical setting?
Well, the paper offers this brilliant vignette of an exhausted caregiver. We have an older adult caring for a spouse with severe dementia. This caregiver comes into the clinic presenting with profound insomnia, low mood, feelings of guilt, physical lethargy.
Classic major depressive disorder presentation.
Right. A traditional psychiatric approach might run down the DSM criteria, quickly diagnose MDD, and prescribe an SSRI to boost serotonin. But if we use the clinical grammar, we look at their margin. Margin is the physiological and emotional reserve an organism has to handle perturbations. Autopoetically, this caregiver's margins are bankrupt. Their sleep architecture is fragmented. Their metabolic systems are stressed from irregular meals.
I see.
Structurally, their coupling with the world is entirely constrained by duty and isolation. Their perception is locked into hypervigilance.
But wouldn't an SSRI still be medically necessary to prevent a severe deterioration in their mood?
It might be a tool, sure, but if you only treat the mood without treating the depleted margin, you are completely ignoring the biological reality of that organism. The grammar forces the clinician to recognize that respite care, sleep protection, and redistributing the daily burden must precede or at least accompany the chemical intervention. You can't just medicate an empty battery. You have to recharge the physiological margin.
I hear that, but how is that functionally different from a standard biopsychosocial assessment? I mean, any competent clinician already asks about sleep, diet, stress, and social support.
It's a shifting.
My primary concern is that by hyper-focusing on these abstract concepts of margin and structural coupling, we risk missing acute, life-threatening medical realities. We cannot let philosophy delay medicine. The paper itself includes a critical red flags and rule-outs for exactly this reason.
Right. It explicitly acknowledges that a life coherence formulation must prioritize clinical safety.
It does, but imagine a patient presenting with severe insomnia and sudden aggressive psychosis, or rapidly progressive cognitive decline. If a clinician is trained to frame this primarily as a depleted margin or a loss of viable options in their environment, they might dangerously delay an urgent lumbar puncture or an MRI.
Well,
that patient could have delirium, autoimmune encephalitis, or severe metabolic instability from an eating disorder. The clinical grammar feels too soft and open to interpretation for acute, time-sensitive crises.
I think that's a fair warning, but I would challenge your premise about the biopsychosocial model. Do standard biopsychosocial formulations actually treat the environment as part of the illness, or do they just treat it as secondary context?
They treat it as a trigger.
Exactly, a trigger. In the standard model, the environment is just a stressor that triggers the real illness, which is located exclusively inside the brain circuitry. But the concept of structural coupling tells us the person and the world co-develop. The environment isn't just context, it is part of the biological loop itself. The paper is absolutely clear that you never ignore medical red flags.
Right.
But it argues that even when you are stabilizing an acute crisis with medication, the ultimate goal of healing has to be viable recoupling with a livable world, not just symptom suppression.
But this is where the framework gets into risky territory, specifically regarding how it redefines those very symptoms. It relies on what the paper calls cross-cutting process logics. Essentially, it reframes almost all psychiatric symptoms as attempts at biological viability. It treats symptoms as regulatory acts.
Exactly. And that is the most profound paradigm shift in the entire text. It fundamentally changes the definition of pathology. Let's look at obsessive-compulsive disorder.
Okay.
Typically, we view compulsions as senseless, broken brain circuitry, a glitch in the machine. but the framework views OCD as ritualized regulation.
Wait, let's unpack that for a second. You're saying the framework views the compulsion, like washing hands until they bleed, as an active life jacket the brain is using?
Yes, precisely. It is a biologically driven attempt to tolerate an internal state of unbearable uncertainty and threat. The organism is trying to regulate its distress by ritualizing its environment. Or consider addiction.
Okay, addiction.
The framework doesn't frame addiction as a moral failing or purely as a mechanical dopamine deficit. It defines it as narrowed regulation around relief and reward. A substance becomes biologically privileged because it offers the organism the only reliable relief when all other domains of action or meaning are closed off. This lens deeply respects the life protective function of the symptom. It acknowledges that the organism is trying to save itself.
Even when the strategy it's using ultimately becomes destructive.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. Framing deeply destructive, neurologically entrenched loops as regulatory acts risks severely romanticizing dangerous pathology.
How so?
Let's look at how the paper describes bipolar mania. It frames mania as an expansion of action possibility with weakened constraint. It treats the manic state almost phenomenologically as an alternative domain of action where the world suddenly becomes radiant with affordance.
Right. It looks at the lived experience.
But mania is not just an alternative way of interacting with the world. It is a severe, neurotoxic, biological crisis. When a patient is manic, sleep entirely disappears. Their behavioral pacing vanishes. They might drain their life savings or step into traffic because they feel invincible. The autopoietic and relational costs are devastating.
It is incredibly dangerous, yes.
Mania requires immediate, absolute, often pharmacological constraint to literally protect the brain from damage. If clinicians sit back and analyze this state as an expansion of possibility, they are failing their fundamental medical duty to protect the patient from severe, irreversible harm.
Look, I have to push back on the framework myself here, because your point highlights a very real tension in the text. Let me use an analogy.
Go ahead.
If a plant's roots are rotting because they are submerged in flooded, overwatered soil, framing the situation as a plant regulating its aquatic intake doesn't drain the water. The roots are still rotting. I admit that.
Thank you.
Slavik goes this to you. When the paper discusses psychosis, it describes it as altered salience. It suggests the boundary between self and world becomes unstable, and ordinary, everyday signals become incredibly over-meaningful or terrifying. If the goal is to respect the patient's lived experience, how does this framework prevent a well-meaning clinician from simply validating those delusions rather than treating the underlying biological fire?
That is exactly my concern. Empathy is a crucial tool in psychiatry, but empathy does not reverse dopamine hyperactivity in the mesolimbic pathway. If a patient is experiencing terrifying persecutory delusions, the framework suggests we shouldn't win an argument against the delusion, but rather try to intimately understand the meaning world they're inhabiting.
Right.
I agree, we shouldn't argue with them, but psychosis often involves profound neurochemical dysregulation. If we prioritize mapping their altered salience over promptly administering an antipsychotic medication to stabilize their neurobiology, we are doing them a massive disservice.
But the framework explicitly states that it does neither of those extremes. It doesn't validate delusions as objective facts, but it also refuses to dismiss the patient's lived world as mere nonsense. It explicitly argues that medication is frequently necessary to restore that physiological margin we talked about earlier.
Right.
But it insists that medication alone is insufficient. I think you are underestimating the biological rigor woven throughout this paper. It doesn't ignore biology. It specifically integrates modern interoception and allostasis.
You mean the neuroimmune pathways?
Yes. The framework fully embraces neuroimmune psychiatry. It acknowledges the gut-brain axis, neuroinflammation, and heart-brain dynamics. Consider how it reframes panic disorder. Traditional cognitive approaches might treat panic purely as irrational fear, a cognitive error.
Cognitive behavioral therapy focuses on that, yes.
But the life coherence model understands panic as an interoceptive crisis.
Interoception being the brain's perception of the body's internal state.
Exactly. The body's internal alarm system is misreading its own regulatory signals. ordinary cardiac acceleration, maybe just from walking up a flight of stairs, is misinterpreted by the brain as impending death. So standard cognitive reassurance completely fails because the alarm isn't just a thought, it is deeply embodied.
So how does the framework treat it?
To treat it, you have to repair the patient's sleep, lower their systemic inflammatory burden, and use interoceptive exposure to retrain the nervous system. The framework applies this logic to neurodevelopmental differences too. It views ADHD and autism not simply as mechanical deficits inside a broken brain, but as coupling mismatches.
Meaning the friction is between the individual and the environment?
Right. The distress arises because an organism with a highly specific sensory and communicative organization is forced to survive in environments that demand incredibly narrow, rigid neurotypical norms. The pathology isn't isolated solely inside the autistic person. It exists in the friction between their embodiment and the world's unrelenting demands.
That's a compelling argument, but have you considered the sheer overwhelming scope of what this demands of the practicing clinician?
It asks for a comprehensive view, yes.
The paper frequently cites the World Health Organization's emphasis on social determinants of health. Things like poverty, systemic racism, displacement, and structural exclusion. It argues that these factors are not just secondary context, but are the very fabric of the patient's structural coupling.
Which the data absolutely supports.
It does. But the paper itself offers a critical warning that I think undermines its own clinical utility. It states, quote, "Social systems are not organisms in the same sense as cells. We cannot simply take biological concepts, like autopoiesis, and uncritically project them onto massive social institutions."
Well,
by blurring the lines between a patient's internal neuroimmune dynamics and external structural societal issues, you place an impossible burden on the psychiatrist. A doctor can prescribe sleep aids. A doctor can guide interoceptive exposure. A doctor can monitor inflammatory markers. A doctor cannot fix systemic poverty, cure institutional racism, or reverse climate instability.
I completely agree, but
if we require clinicians to incorporate systemic societal failures into a medical diagnosis, the framework threatens to turn targeted medical treatment into abstract public policy.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning, because the framework doesn't ask the psychiatrist to fix systemic poverty. It asks the psychiatrist to accurately, scientifically locate the source of the biological breakdown. We talked about allostasis earlier. Allostatic load is the biological wear and tear on the body from chronic stress.
Yes.
It is measurable. It is endocrinology, not politics. If a patient presents with severe depression and physical collapse because they are working three precarious jobs just to survive crushing debt, their HPA axis is constantly firing. Their cortisol is chronically elevated. Diagnosing them with a primary spontaneous neurochemical deficit and sending them away with just an SSRI is intellectually dishonest.
But we can measure that allostatic load without needing the framework's philosophical jargon.
We can measure it, yes, but how do we formulate it? The environment is acting as a continuous biological perturbator. A life-coherent psychiatry forces us to admit that if we take a biologically stabilized patient and send them right back into a toxic, coercive medium, their living coherence will inevitably fracture again. Social policy is, in effect, a mental health intervention.
Acknowledging the profound reality of social determinants does not require us to abandon the precision of our clinical tools. This is why I keep returning to RDoC and HITOP. They allow us to measure the exact dimensions of that allostatic load. We can track the cortisol. We can measure the heart rate variability. We can quantify the affective action tendencies. We can do all of that with objective data.
But
we don't need a philosophical grammar about emotioning or legitimate coexistence. The massive risk of using subjective terms like meaning worlds in a clinical setting is that you cannot standardize them. How do you standardize a measurement of a patient's living coherence across 100 different hospitals?
You think it's too subjective to be reliable?
Yes, the paper explicitly admits this is a limitation, stating that the constructs must be operationalized before they can be scientifically useful at scale. Until we can reliably measure these 7 primitives across different clinicians and get the same results, it remains a heuristic. It's a beautiful way to think about a patient, but it is not a science.
But science without a coherent philosophy of the organism becomes nothing more than blind data gathering. Our doc is brilliant at giving us dimensions, genes, molecules, neural circuits, observable behaviors. But as Dr. Solly's paper notes, we still need a life process account that links all those isolated dimensions back to actual self-maintenance and lived worlds.
Because they serve survival.
Exactly. Why do those neural circuits even matter? Because they serve the organism's autopoiesis. Dr. Sahili's life coherence framework is essential precisely because it bridges that gap. It demands that we stop treating the patient as a disembodied grain or a walking cluster of statistical dimensions. Healing cannot simply be about suppressing the panic attack or dulling the OCD compulsion with a pill.
Right.
Healing has to mean viable recoupling. That means reopening paths of action, restoring the person's biological margin so they can feel their own life truthfully again.
I don't disagree with the goal of holistic healing. Not at all. The framework offers a deeply humane phenomenological lens. It forces clinicians to remember that patients are living beings embedded in incredibly complex histories and environments, not just broken machines waiting for a mechanic.
Exactly.
But a lens is not a treatment protocol. The broad philosophical concepts of autopoiesis and emotional sentience simply lack the data-driven, dimensional precision needed to reliably guide acute psychiatric care. In moments of severe biological destabilization, when delirium sets in, or when mania escalates into clear danger, we need the strict, unambiguous boundaries of medical science, not the fluid grammar of philosophy.
Yet, listening to us debate this, we both seem to arrive at a strong point of convergence. We both acknowledge that categorical diagnoses, the simple checkboxes of the DSM, are entirely insufficient on their own.
They are.
And whether a clinician prefers the strict terminology of RDoC or the systemic terminology of structural coupling, we completely agree that understanding a patient's interoceptive reality, how they physically feel their body's alarms, and their environmental context is absolutely vital for any durable recovery.
We do. The mechanistic approach, the idea of just isolating the faulty spark plug and swapping it out, has demonstrably failed to capture the complexity of psychiatric illness. Our debate today is really over how we map that immense complexity without losing our empirical footing in the process.
Exactly. It comes down to whether we are willing to look at the whole living system, even when it resists easy categorization. We began today with the metaphor of the dying plant. It is easy to just paint the leaves green, but the human mind, the living organism, defies that kind of elegant isolation.
It really does.
Perhaps the greatest challenge in the future of psychiatry is learning how to treat the symptoms without forgetting that those symptoms belong to a biological organism that actually has to navigate a very real, very complex world. There is profound depth in Dr. Safihil's white paper, and we've only just scratched the surface of how this might reshape clinical care. We encourage our listeners to explore the source material and decide for themselves how the field should evolve.
It is certainly a framework that forces you to question the foundations of everything you thought you knew about a psychiatric diagnosis.
So, as we close, ask yourself, when a living system breaks down, are we just looking for the broken part, or are we finally ready to look at the life that surrounds it?